This is 20 minutes of marketing and PR insights by SCA, the Space Communication Alliance.
Hello, and welcome to your monthly digest of 20 minutes of marketing and PR insights by SCA, the world's first marketing and communications network for the space sector. This podcast is produced by Spacewatch Global, your independent voice of space, for SCA, the Space Communications Alliance. SCA is a dedicated network of leading specialists, independent PR, marketing, and communications agencies for the space sector. Together, we form an international and interdisciplinary team of experts who've been at the forefront of space and technology for decades.
Tapping into this expertise and international network, this podcast provides bite-sized insights and views from some of SCA's most influential members. We aim to bring you actionable marketing and PR best practice and excellence that you can apply to your business today. We're your hosts. I'm joined by Business Development Specialist Anam Davis.
And I'm joined by PR Director Roxanne Kingsman. We're both from B2B PR consultancy Spreckley, based in London, and one of the founding members of the SCA. Hello, and welcome to our third episode. Today, we're joined again by the very impressive Emma Garty. We spoke to her last time about her really impressive track record being a scientist, a really fascinating communication story and journey. She's a researcher and scientist by trade, specialized in geochemistry and planetary sciences. And we spoke a lot about the difference in scientific writing and academic writing, her being from an academic background. And we spoke a lot about the different nuances and different issues in science. So really interesting episode. Please do tune in. We didn't get through all of the questions that we had for her, so she's back on again for episode 3. And I think this time we'll focus more on her role at Spacewatch Global. We didn't actually touch on what you're writing about here. Hello, Emma, and thank you for joining us again.
Hi, Anum. Hi, Roxanne. It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
Pleasure to have you back, and thank you again for your time. As Anam said, we covered a lot in our first conversation, and I feel like we could easily speak to you for more episodes than this. So we'll try and keep this fairly concise if we can. But again, given your breadth of research and your mix of your career, there's so much that we can cover. But today we'd love to put a spotlight on Spacewatch Global. And our first question is very much around, and we touched on this last time, what do you enjoy writing about for Spacewatch Global especially?
Yeah, it's something that we touched last episode. I personally, when I write, because I do two things, I'm a writer and a podcaster, so I'm a content producer for Spacewatch Global, but I'm also the editor, so I'm the one deciding or trying to decide or pretending to decide, depend from the point of view, the storyline and the long-term editorial direction of Spacewatch Global. When I write, so when I'm wearing my journalist hat, which is something that I still don't feel completely comfortable in, to be honest, because I don't come from a journalist training. I still come from research. And I think you can see it in my writing. I still come from a strong scientific and academic approach to writing. What I like to write the most is when we discuss real life application of space to Earth issues. I like to discuss how space can actually be a tool of change, a tool of improvement, a tool for humanity to solve its problems and don't create new ones, which is more important. And doing this, I noticed how much of our approach to space, or in general to technology, is still somehow, I'm going to say this word, which is not the right word, so take it between commas, is still a bit primitive. When I say primitive, I mean that somehow humanity does the same mistakes over and over and over again. And it seems we cannot learn from what we've done before. Like every time we invented something, we did it to resolve a problem. Like plastic is the classic example that is used. Okay, we invented plastic because we wanted to stop using paper, which was becoming a problem because we kept cutting trees. So that was an issue, and we solved the issue. And then plastic became obviously very successful because it's much more practical and easy to produce. So we invented plastic, but we didn't invent how to get rid of it, how to solve the problem of the waste. It seems, and in space, I see the same problem. We invented satellites, we keep launching, and then at some point we realize that, oh my God, we're just filling up the orbit with trash, with rubbish, and we don't know how to take them back, and we don't know how to recycle them. And it's over and over and over the same problem. We use too many resources compared to the rhythm that we can produce them. We don't consider our planet and its resources as nothing else than our property. And this is something that upset me because I see this issue, this mindset coming back over and over again. The orbit is our orbit. We can trash it as much as we want. The forests are our forests. We can cut them completely. The oceans are just a big pool when we can keep fishing until there will not be fish. So what I enjoy to do, or what I try to do, and this is presumption in a sort of way, okay? So I know that I'm just a drop in the sea, but when I write about how space can solve a problem, or how can space prevent an issue, is trying to bring people to see the necessity to change our mindset, to stop keep using Earth as our own personal resource, our own property, because it's not. Nature, in all its shape and forms, is not something that we own. We are part of it. If we keep destroying it, we're destroying us. And this is the mentality where I come from. This is my ethic. This is how I write. And this is how I approach technology. I never think it's a tool by itself. If you read any of my articles, I don't come from a space geek background. And there is a huge stereotype in our industry, which is the Big Ben theory stereotypes, the classic nerd geeks that they love to speak about technology and they are like proper physics nerds. There is nothing wrong with it. Absolutely. It's fantastic. It's good fun. It's what bring a lot of like-minded together. But I think it's necessary to shift a bit, not shift, to introduce another perspective, the perspective of people that they think about technology as a tool to improve humanity and to introduce a new mindset and a new behavior in how we approach the future. And this is something that is very important for me. And sometimes it worries me how under the words of like, oh, space is going to be the new revolution, the new golden era, the new exploration of humanity. And then underneath, I find the same value that were of the old industrial revolution. Abuse of power, abuse of human forces, modern slavery, environmental destruction, whatever.
Yeah, really interesting. And there's a lot, obviously, about technology in general, you know, being used for good. We see it with our other clients and other in other kind of spaces as well. We see it, you know, use technology for good. Have you noticed any other topics in particular for Spacewatch Global that are kind of trending at the moment? Obviously, sustainability is one, but are there any other topics you've noticed this year? And do you find that it changes from year to year?
Well, I think there are three topics. The first one is debris. We are really worried about debris and debris regulation as at satellites in low Earth orbits because we keep launching satellites. I was reading a report last week and it's like 50 satellites a week. The Earth is big, the orbit is bigger, but there is no space for everyone. And again, we think about launching, we think about the profit, we think about the benefits, but you don't think about taking them back. So that's an issue. That's definitely something that is worrying the international community, both on the technological side and on the regulatory side. The second one is the geopolitical equilibrium, China, US, Russia, the militarization of space, which is a strange term because it seems something new. It's not something new. It's always been there. In fact, as a matter of fact, I remember one intervention of Teresa Itchkin several years ago in Spacewatch Global when they say space and militarization have always been connected, which is true. In fact, as a matter of fact, I think she said space was born from a military idea. The beginning of space was in the military. So it's a bit a stretch to say that it is a new militarization of space. No, it's always been that it's just becoming a bit more evident because the geopolitical situation, the situation is becoming more and more edgy between the Western world and the Eastern world. So that's also a topic that we hear a lot. It has to be discussed with extreme care because it takes nothing to foment this and to push people that want to have a war in space over the edge. So he has to be, I'm very careful with that topic in general. And the third topic that I see, and I would like to see more, and I don't think is explored enough, is overall the application of space technology for Earth and sustainable issues, agriculture, environment, forest, monitoring of the oceans, and climate, of course, which is something that, in my opinion, is not dealt with enough, because we should, this is again my editorial choice, of course, so you can, there is a bias in this, but I would like to see this much more, and I would like to see treated and dealt with in a bit of a different way how it is now, because at the moment, yes, a bit of a tool approach, like they start from the satellite to tell you the story. I personally think that it's the wrong way to deal with technology and science, starting from the tools, because humanity in general is not really interested in tools. It's not interested in satellite. This is something that the industry seems completely blind to. We keep telling the story starting from the tool, starting from the satellite, instead of starting from the problem. And the problem is something that humanity can understand because we see it with our own eyes every day. And is a tangible concept, why satellite remains an abstract concept for 99% of the population. So climate is something that I'm trying to push as much as possible to bring out those stories of space at the service of the society, at the service of a huge problem that we are having. We knew climate change was happening, but I would like to see some action and some serious intervention on how space can deal with this problem.
Just a follow-on question really from that. How do you think, in your opinion, space community and space can be more sustainable and, you know, save the planet?
What it seems is missing is the link between data production and data application. So space so far has deal with data production and make sure that data are correct. It's monitoring the situation. If you want to think it in hospital metaphors, space is the X-ray machine that is telling you that your knee is broken. Okay? Is an X-ray diagram that shows you that the knee is broken, but it does not provide applicative solution, how to heal this knee. So that's where I would like to see a major intervention of space, because all this data, they have to be translated into policy and politics and political decisions. Otherwise, we don't do anything with data. We have thousands of data, okay? Some data are useless, some data are very useful. There is all a debate about the need of more local data. There is a debate, which is correct, about freedom of data so that small NGOs, international organizations, nonprofit can actually access this data. That's another discussion. But in general, how we use the data to produce a policy, a regulation, an improvement, then that's where I see the gap fundamentally. It seems there is not an entity that is translating the data that the space sector produces into something tangible, into an action. Okay, there is a huge climate inaction. Okay?
Yeah.
And that's where I ask myself and I ask around, what is the role of space? Shall we also translate this data into statistics, into projection, into suggestion to politicians? One thing, if I produce a map with pixels that show coastline issues, and one thing, if I go to the local politician, I say, look, in 10 years, we have 70% of chances that all this part of coastline, all the houses will be completely submerged. So that's a very practical statistic that politicians can understand. You have to translate what you do into a language that policy, lawmakers, council makers, government bodies can understand. Then if they don't want to listen, that's another topic. But that's something that it has to be work on both sides.
It goes back to our first conversation, really, about trust and communication, doesn't it? There's a huge focus on the way that data is presented and communicated to decision makers, to the public. And invariably, there is a politicization of science to that extent, because any decision made on the basis of any data has a real world and therefore political impact. So it's a very complex issue, isn't it? And it can seem quite frustrating because with the data, it's the lack of bias behind that, the research and the quite straightforward problem solution focus, for there to be inaction is frustrating.
It's frustrating for us that we are the citizens. In the end, we deal with the consequences only. I'm not a politician, Roxanne. So when I speak, I don't speak from a political point of view. I don't have a political language. I realize it completely. I'm a former scientist who is deal with data and now a media communicator. What I think is difficult. So I don't mean frustrating or difficult. And I'm not even attaching a moral value to this. What is difficult is that to understand that to resolve this issue, to resolve climate change, we need much more than simple technical patches here and there. We need literally a radical transformation of how we live, how we set up our lives. I'll give you an example, electric cars. It upset me, the debate on electric cars, because it's all focused on, shall we change the car? Shall we have an electric car? Like, if that one is the solution, we don't even know how to recycle the batteries of the electric cars. Again, you know, you invent something, you don't think how to recycle it. Going back to the same mentality again and again and again, like, well, what are we going to do? We're going to transform Earth in a huge pit, digging lithium everywhere and then dropping batteries in the ocean? Foolish. So, first point, we have not dealt with the consequences of a huge energy transition. The amount of resources that we need to transform the entire world in green energy, like in solar panels, for example, it's incredible. The projection of the amount of aluminium, iron, copper that we need are absurd. My point is that the technological transition is the tip of the iceberg. Because if we keep living as we're living now, we keep wasting too much. So it's not about choosing between one car and the other. It's about choosing to change radically how we live so that we need less car. That's the goal. We need less energy. We can be self-sustainable when we produce. That's where the goal is. That's where the debate should be. Not a simple shifting in technology. Sorry.
I can't help but think there seems to be this escapist mentality away from the organic, away from the natural process of the world. Transhumanism tries to move away from mortality of the body. We want to become almost cyborg. We want to become intrinsic with technology and to escape from our bodily needs, because that's seen as evolution as opposed to being connected. And it seems like when we think about science research, the frustration is that there's a pull again away from the earth, away from the natural state of the world, and a short-sightedness in the kind of technologies that are produced and even in the climate solutions. For example, you talked about electric cars. It's a solution, but it's almost a short-sighted one because we haven't thought about how we reuse, recycle, and have a circularity in that process. And so there is this short-sighted nature to the solution that's proposed, whereas perhaps there's a sense of thinking beyond the radical shift of how we live, because it's such a mind shift. Psychologically, yeah. It's difficult to do. That's a big debate and a big topic, but it just makes me feel like there's this big division.
No, well, absolutely. Look at what happened when we imposed to use a mask to save your life for a couple of years. People revolted it. Think if you're going to tell them, oh, you cannot eat meat anymore, sorry. Or you can have one hot shower every 2 days. Okay? So people rebelled against their freedom to don't wear a mask, which could have saved their life, by the way. So that's the extent of how difficult it is to have a mind shift. Merit of what you said, this mindset that keeps thinking about humanity, natural evolution of humanity towards a more and more detached approach to what we really are, which are animals attached to the earth, to the land. I completely agree with you. I mean, this is a much broader discussion, but to bring it back to space, that's what I try to fight. An approach in which space tech is something to bring us even more distant from Earth, something to detach us even more from humanity. I do personally profoundly believe that what we need is a bit more humanity. So when I think about space, I don't think about space how it can take me on Mars. I think about how it can help me to build a local community when I'm not dependent from my car anymore, when I can have an energy sustainment that can allow me to live in a more sustainable way that can preserve me, my family, my community, because we are communities. we belong to each other. Humanity is a huge tribal village. Even after 5,000 years or 10,000 years from when we started to spread on Earth, this is the wrong number, by the way. I know if there was an anthropologist listening to me, it would be that 10,000 years is completely inaccurate. And I know it, and I apologize for that to the scientific community. I apologize for it. But yeah, so in my little bubble, this is how I approach science. And this is how I approach space science.
So more humanity in the world of science. I'm conscious of time, but we have a couple of questions coming back to Space Watch that we'd love to get your insights on today, if we can. And in fact, this somewhat leads on to your reference to the fact that we are tribal and we need to foster a community, especially in the world of science and space research. You've worked in the science world and in the world of academia across both sides of the world, US, Europe, from NASA through to your editorial role. Have you observed any key cultural and geopolitical differences in those communities, even other cultures and communities?
Oh my God, huge question. Yes, of course. Impossible to give you a detailed answer in a few minutes, but yeah, let's try to tailor it to communication. So we stick to the topic because then, of course, there are like cultural difference, political difference, life difference, so many mindset differences. So let's stick it to one little niche so I can give you a better answer. First of all, bear in mind that I'm European. So I see the US like the different from my traditional mentality. So that's important to say it. You know, I come from European perspective. So the US is the other from me. I always profoundly admire, and part of my life choices after NASA come from that, how NASA could do what is for me an incredible job of outreach. I still don't know how they can merge advertisement, education, information, entertainment all together in one. It comes from Hollywood. Hollywood is the same. In the 30s, if you think, it was a propaganda machine, but was a propaganda machine through entertainment. So it runs in their DNA. I don't know what's the secret. Every time I see how they do outreach, I'm like, wow, they do it better. And it's not only about, obviously, they invest more money because they believe in it. They believe that communication outreach is fundamental to their goal, something that in Europe don't have. The times that we have to fight to reserve a budget for communication when we speak with our clients, because it seems like the last of the problems, literally. So it's always a very tiny budget for communication and outreach. Sometimes the tiny budget is zero, to give you the difference in mentality. The US always has a budget for communication, is a big budget because they believe in it. Because they believe it's part of the strategy, something that in Europe is never like that, is never part of the strategy. So first of all, they have a different approach. They think the communication is part of the strategy. Second, they just have a culture, an ability to merge advertisement, education, information, and entertainment. Something that I admire profoundly, because we don't have it. I am Italian. In Italy, something that is academic or is institutional absolutely has to have a gravitas to it. It has to have a seriousness to it. Anglo-Saxon countries in general are different. The UK, for example, from my experience, is the closest to the US in the sense. You have in the UK an ability, not as marked as them, but still an ability to be able to produce something that is informational, is educational, is interesting, and is engaging. In Europe, in general, we struggle a lot. We perceive as if something is informational, it has to be dry. If something has to be educational, it has to be proper. And if something is entertaining, can go whatever they want. We are not able to merge the three things, which I think is a profound mistake. It's not correct to call it a mistake. I'm going to call it a limit, a limitation. I always wonder if it's a cultural limitation. I mean, during the ceremony for Biden's presidency, the opening said there was Lady Gaga singing. I cannot imagine in Italy, in Germany, or in France, anybody inviting the co-respective Lady Gaga to sing. Can you imagine it? Even in the UK, think about the coronation ceremony, such a huge, profound, middle age in Latin. It was in Latin. We come from a culture intrinsically connected with religion, with so many rituals that for us is very difficult to break those rituals, step into the modern world and think about, hey, let's do something that can be fresh, that can be new, and at the same time can be educational. And honestly, I don't have an answer to why we can. The only thing I can think of is millennia of history that don't allow us this freedom. But that's a huge cultural difference I see, and it upset me to see how much better they are than us in that.
It's interesting that there's a segue almost into PR for science in that response, because it's about translating information for different audiences and being able to engage with an entirely different segment than any institution might normally expect to engage with. Perhaps the sense of needing to nurture the next generation and to reach a broader audience than the science community, which, as we discussed on our first conversation, is not easy.
No.
It's not, indeed.
Yeah, really interesting. And we've spoken before about, when we spoke to Remco in our first episode, how well NASA are doing it. I think he mentioned NASA were the first kind of space, you know, company to go on Twitter and use Twitter as well as they do now. And each astronaut had a personality and was talking and engaging and communicating with the audiences. And that mindset that you spoke about coming from the West is really, really kind of something to learn from for the rest of the world, really.
I feel like, again, we could easily go on for hours, and for every question, we could have dived into that into so much more detail. But the name of this podcast is 20 minutes. That's often the biggest challenge for us. So 20 minutes, that's a good point to wrap up with. Thank you so much again for your time, Emma. It's always a real pleasure to speak with you. Your experience is impressive, to say the least, and your passion for humanity and for science is really inspiring. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Roxanne. Thank you, Anum. It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me and allowing me to blather for half an hour, more, almost 1 hour, considering episode 2. And of course, I wish you the best for the next episode.
Thank you so much. Thanks very much for your time.